Our interest must be on bringing about peace. That if we truly care and are compassionate for the Syrian people, these children and women and innocent people who are being most impacted by this war, we need to end this destructive regime change war, not escalate it as the president has just done.
What it indicates is a willingness on the part of high-level people in the White House to distort, to use intelligence claims that are false to make political points and political arguments. And this is a serious, intolerable situation.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital.
Produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Averam. And on today's show, we're going to continue to talk real talk about war and violence in our society, even despite whatever physical, mental, or emotional protections we want to create for ourselves. It is difficult to live in April 2017 without also experiencing violence in some way. Whether it be continued U.S.-involved killing of men, women, and children in Yemen, Iraq, Afghanistan, and across the Middle East, or fresh videos of state police terror in American communities, or the assault by private police on an elderly doctor dragged from a United Airlines flight. And the way that all this violence is becoming normalized is also a violence. The way that American news organizations sanction war and barbarism to support the neoliberal war agenda and then ignore other deaths is also a violence and a warping of the human conscience. The way that Americans are asked to repeat the same error made up in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq of following so-called intelligence with no proof is a violence, and it should be a worn-out playbook by now. Speaking of a worn-out playbook, does the U.S. empire even want peace in Syria, or does it want another failed state like it produced in Iraq and Libya? Later in the show, we'll be speaking with writer and activist Sam Husseini about his new article in Counterpunch, Is U.S. Policy to Prolong the Syrian War? And we'll also be joined by journalist John Jeter in a dissection of the worst sins and lies of corporate media. So, you know how we do. We have a lot for you packed into our hour, and we'll start with our headlines. As the Democratic Party faithful join Republicans in praising President Trump's illegal airstrike on Syria, Representative Tulsi Gabbard, Democrat of Hawaii, is one of the few in Congress stating skepticism about Trump's shift toward regime change in Syria, as well as the supposed proof from the intelligence community that Syria's President Bashar al-Assad is responsible for last week's chemical attack. This week, regulars of the Clinton-Obama Democratic Party machine, such as Howard Dean, took to Twitter denouncing Gabbard, an Iraq veteran who has consistently opposed U.S. wars of regime change. Here she is speaking to CNN's Wolf Blitzer.
I'm interested in finding the solution, and the solution is to end this counterproductive regime change war. The United States has been waging, along with allies, so-called allies like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, all seeking to overthrow the Syrian government. We have been providing arms, funding, salary, support, intelligence, and other types of both direct and indirect support to armed militants within Syria who are working directly with al-Qaeda, who are allied with terrorist groups like al-Qaeda towards this end of overthrowing the Syrian government, all an action which has resulted in more chaos and suffering for the Syrian people, as well as counterproductive to our American national security interests by strengthening the very enemy that attacked us on 9/11. As a veteran, I have seen the cost of these wars, experienced them firsthand, seen the human cost in friends of mine who did not come home from the war in Iraq. I went to Congress promising my constituents, my fellow veterans and brothers and sisters in uniform that I would do all I could to prevent our country from making these kinds of disastrous and destructive mistakes again in the future.
Gabbard was also one of 30 U.S. lawmakers who wrote the Trump administration this week about his decision to sell so-called smart bombs or precision-guided munitions to Saudi Arabia, which has been bombing Yemen for the last 2 years, leading to 10,000 people, mainly civilians, dead or injured. In addition, there's a looming humanitarian crisis with millions starving. This week, Code Pink organized several actions here in D.C., including a demonstration that greeted war makers at the Pentagon as they showed up for work, a call for the public to fast on Thursday for Yemen, and a rally outside the embassy of Saudi Arabia on Wednesday, where activist Medea Benjamin, along with other protesters, appealed to those inside to stop the killing.
So we are here holding pictures of suffering Yemeni children. Yemeni children who we don't know if they are dead or alive today. Their children who have been hurt by the combination of war and starvation. The Saudis have been bombing Yemen continually for the last 2 years. Sir, do you work for the Saudi government? Please stop killing the children of Yemen. Stop killing the children in Yemen. Stop killing the children in Yemen. Stop killing the children of Yemen.
The gathering at the embassy was passionate but small, especially when compared with the crowd that crammed into Busboys and Poets at 14th and V Streets, located in Northwest D.C., to hear about another human rights atrocity. Seattle Seahawks defensive lineman Michael Bennett spoke Monday night about his refusal to participate in a junket to Israel because of its violations of human rights against the Palestinian people. Chantel James has more.
The 14th and V location of Busboys and Poets was packed with activists and sports fans on Monday night, with scores of people turned away as the venue filled to capacity. The crowd had come to welcome activist and NFL athlete Michael Bennett, who has been praised for his refusal to patronize an apartheid Israel, his vocal support of the Black Lives Matter movement, and his generous donations of his economic resources to progressive causes. The father of three daughters gave his take on the urgency of this political moment and disclosed the personal motivations of his activism. Here, he tells us why he supported the Women's March in January and reminds us of how essential it is that all human beings respect the rights of women.
Now that I have daughters, it's like so important to me. Like, to really see like how women are really treated, and like my eyes are so open now, because it's like now with my daughters, I'm just seeing how things really are. And I think it was important to me to speak up on it, because women are the future. Women are the main people who always stepped up first in every single conflict that's been on in American history. The men might get the credit for it, but it's always been women that stepped up and like,
from 14th and V, this is Chantal James signing off.
Bennett said that he continues to support former San Francisco quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who started the trend of sitting down or kneeling during the national anthem at the start of games to protest against police brutality. And this week marked the two-year anniversary of the illegal arrest of Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old black man in Baltimore who ultimately died in police custody with his spine 80% severed at the neck. Gray's death sparked weeks of unrest and led to the unusual indictment and charges against six Baltimore police officers, none of whom were ultimately convicted. Marilyn Mosby, the city state's attorney, said her office's investigation of Gray's death has been thwarted because of its reliance on police to gather most of the evidence against the police. A separate probe of Gray's death by the Justice Department remained unresolved when former Attorney General Loretta Lynch left office. And the current Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has expressed no interest or hostility to such police investigations. And finally, speaking of investigations, D.C. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton is calling for investigation of the incident on United Airlines this week when a 65-year-old medical doctor, David Dow, was violently ejected from his seat when a flight was overbooked. Norton released her letter to congressional committees requesting a hearing on the incident, saying, quote, "The public is incensed and the video images from fellow passengers are disturbing enough to warrant a public hearing by our committee when the House returns from recess. The outrage over the incident has continued, and I believe it is appropriate for Congress to take an action." Norton, a Democrat of D.C., is a senior member of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and its Subcommittee on Aviation. Now, joining me to talk about the United incident and congressional action or inaction is our geopolitical analyst, Gerald Horn, Professor Gerald Horn of the University of Houston. Gerald, I think you must have quite a few frequent flyer miles. You're the most flying person I know. So what was your reaction to what happened on United?
Well, I wasn't shocked at all. I've been expelled from flights myself, although I have to confess I did not allow myself to be dragged down the aisle and suffer a concussion and a broken nose and endure reconstructive surgery as a result. I think that we have to realize that this incident is the direct fruit of deregulation, that is to say, removing the federal government from the job of regulating airlines. This accelerated, if not began, under the regime of President Jimmy Carter and the Cornell University late economist Albert Kahn, who told us that deregulation would be a boon to flyers, but it has not been so. The other story that I take away from this disgraceful episode is that it had enormous impact in Asia. It went viral in China before it went viral in the United States. I'm speaking about the video. Right. It also went viral in Vietnam. And I think it's going to complicate U.S. foreign policy because people in China and Vietnam have the sneaking suspicion that people of obvious Asian ancestry are not treated equally in the United States of America, and they happen to be correct.
Well, I just read how our Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton is calling for at least a hearing in Congress about the incident. And it struck me in her reading her announcement that Congress is going on recess at a time when the president is ramping up attacks around the globe. What's your reaction to the, I guess, inattention of Congress to these military attacks? And there are not many people speaking up saying that it's illegal for Donald Trump to be waging war basically without congressional approval.
Well, the Democrats opened the door for this by congratulating Mr. Trump for his ill-advised illegal attack on Syria just a few days ago. You may also have noticed that in today's papers, there's a story about CIA Director Michael Pompeo denouncing WikiLeaks and basically analogizing it to a hostile intelligence service. But you should also know that Mr. Pompeo spoke in very harsh words about Iran. And many of us feel that the attack on Damascus was really meant to signal Iran that it was next in line to be pummeled. I think as well that these attacks by Mr. Trump, both slated and perhaps projected, are designed to solidify his base. His base is very concerned about his walking back his words with regard to NATO being obsolete, with regard to China being a currency manipulator, with regard to getting rid of Janet Yellen of the Federal Reserve. Yet all wings of his base, both Wall Street and the working class and middle class base, tend to give him high fives when he engages in wars abroad. And I'm afraid that the Democrats have acquiesced to that kind of warmongering.
Well, you know, also, I know that we have some type of war equipment heading toward, weaponry headed toward the Korean Peninsula. And this week, there's actually, in the coming days, there will actually be people here from Korea kind of speaking out and giving the perspective from Korean people and their fight against U.S. THAAD deployment in Korea. And one event is going to be tomorrow, Saturday, at 617 Florida Avenue, Northwest in D.C. Sung-Oi Kim, co-chair of the Songju Struggle Committee to Stop THAAD Deployment, and Hyun Lee, Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea, and Zoom in Korea editorial team. And then I think the same group is going to be appearing later, perhaps Monday, here in D.C. So we have an opportunity here in D.C. to hear from people in Korea who are experiencing this type of hyper-tension, you know, on their peninsula. So why don't we wrap up with some your little-known news for this week?
Well, the left press did report that Donald J. Trump has investments in Raytheon, which manufactures Tomahawk missiles that attacked Syria just a few days ago. And apparently the stock of Raytheon went up after these attacks. The United States will have to replenish the supply, which meant that Mr. Trump actually may have made a personal profit with regard to this attack on Syria. I think that it's well past time for investigative journalists to look into Mr. Trump's words and see how they correlate with his trading. I mean, for example, he talked down the dollar the other day. And of course, did he trade on the dollar before he made those words made those statements to the Wall Street Journal, talking down the dollar. He reversed himself on the Export-Import Bank, which subsidizes exports by major U.S. corporations like Boeing and GE. Before he reversed on the Export-Import Bank, did he make investments in Boeing and GE? The second point I would like to make is that there has been a serious debunking of the fact of the allegation, that President al-Assad in Damascus used chemical attacks, but it has not penetrated the mainstream press. You can find it, however, on Johnson's Russian list, which is published at George Washington University. It aggregates English language sources and translated sources about Russia and Russian foreign policy, and it delivers it old school to your inbox. Just yesterday, they published a number of stories debunking this episode, but sadly and tragically, it has not penetrated the Washington Post as of yet.
Right. We actually have a sound clip from the MIT professor, Theodore Postol, who has done an analysis of the intelligence report and also video of the alleged attack and has totally debunked that this was an airstrike from Assad. And also, you're talking about his taxes. There's a big tax march here in Washington tomorrow, starting at noon at the U.S. Capitol Front Fountain. And I guess thousands of people have signed up to go on Facebook, basically demanding that Donald Trump release all of his tax returns and make his financial interests more transparent. Well, thank you, Gerald. Professor Gerald Horn of the University of Houston, a frequent contributor to this show and across the Pacifica Network.
Thank you.
So finally, in culture and media, movies openings today include the animated feature My Entire High School Sinking into the Sea, about a teenager who is trying to become popular with his peers when an earthquake sends his high school drifting out into the Pacific Ocean. Also in limited edition across the country, A Quiet Passion, about the poet Emily Dickinson, played by Cynthia Nixon of Sex and the City fame, and also the documentary Chasing Train, about the life of jazz great John Coltrane. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, does the U.S. really want to end the war in Syria? Stay with us.
We're United Airlines. You do what we say, when we say, and there won't be a problem. Capiche? If we say you fly, you fly. If not, tough. Give us a problem, and we'll drag your ass off the plane. And if you resist, we'll beat you so badly, you'll be using your own face as a flotation device. United Airlines. F*** you.
That was Chicoria, Forgotten Past, and a United Airlines comedy sketch from Jimmy Kimmel. This is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam. Now, much of the news out of D.C. this week involved debate about President Trump's apparent U-turn in policy toward not only Syria, but on much of his foreign policy. While my next guest says that rather than inconsistent, the U.S. policy is very consistent. Sam Husseini is a writer and activist who is communications director for the Institute for Public Accuracy and a founder of VotePAC.org. His most recent article for Counterpunch is titled, Is U.S. Policy to Prolong the Syrian War? Welcome to On the Ground, Sam.
Good to be with you, Esther.
Well, let's unpack why you asked that question and actually what is the answer. Is that the policy to prolong the war?
It's funny because I wrote that article, I think Counterpunch published it on Friday. Since that time, Tom Friedman had an article in the New York Times basically saying, why are we fighting ISIS in Syria? Why don't we let them all drag this out? Why should it come on our dime? Why don't we keep the Syrians and the Iranians and the Russians bogged down? Oh, yeah, ISIS is real bad. But, you know, them fighting all for years and years in Syria, that's pretty useful to us now, isn't it?
Mm.
And this notion occurs periodically. Donald Trump said it in a debate back in 2015 when he basically just blurted out the same thing. Why are we fighting ISIS in Syria? Let them all kill each other and we can pick out the remnants. It's typical divide and conquer strategy. You know, a lot of people, including a lot of friends, and me to some extent, when Obama didn't strike the Assad regime, and by the way, we're bombing Syria, of course, constantly, right? I mean, people got to understand that. This isn't a novel thing. We're bombing Syria, we're bombing Iraq constantly, bombing Afghanistan. Now they did this big thing for probably publicity purposes, although I'm sure it killed a lot of people, Yemen and so on. The reason that this strike was different is that it was the explicit target was the secular Assad regime and not allegedly being the target allegedly being ISIS. So Obama was about to strike the Assad regime in 2013 and then he pulled back. And people were happy that he did that and I didn't want him to do that. But a predictable consequence of that and the U.S. continuously funding rebels and so on, and to not knock out Assad, to not do regime change, but to let the thing drag out, mm-hmm. is actually quite useful. There have been a lot of indications in policy statements, some from the U.S., some from the Israeli side, saying it's good to have a very weakened Syria, possibly to dismember Syria. You got O'Hanlon over at the Brookings Institute now explicitly saying, let's dismember Syria. Because you don't want powerful, especially secular, Arab governments, because they could pose a counterbalance to U.S., Israeli, and Saudi domination of the region. And that's basically what happened. Remember in 2006, Israel went after Hezbollah, because Hezbollah was siding with the Palestinians. Israel was bombing the hell out of Gaza, killing a ton of Palestinians. Hezbollah said, hell no, you don't. We're going to do something about this. And then Israel ended up invading and hitting Hezbollah in Lebanon. There's basically an alliance between Hezbollah in Lebanon, Syria, and Iran, which is sort of a counterbalance to Israel's domination. And what the Syria war has done that's really useful, and there are WikiLeaks documents about this, saying we want to weaken, from the U.S. government, saying we want to weaken the Assad government, mm-hmm. that they've basically weakened that alliance at its weakest point, because Hezbollah is a vibrant group inside of Lebanon that's very grassroots oriented. They're very difficult for Israel to pull out of there.
So instead of having regime change, I think you point out in your article, it's like they have no regime.
Yeah, I think that might be. A lot of critics assume that the U.S. goal is regime change.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they would like to have a compliant regime in Syria. I think that might be difficult to have a compliant regime in Syria. It's not like Jordan, right? It's not, you know, a small entity. Syria, like Iraq, is the center of a civilization. It's got a substantial population and so on. So the best possible choice from a very Machiavellian U.S. strategic point of view might be a collapsed state.
You know, earlier I played a clip from Tulsi Gabbard. I want to play the clip from Tulsi Gabbard because she talked in her recent interview about the whole situation and about regime change.
We should not continue this counterproductive regime change war to overthrow the Syrian government, first and foremost, because it will be destructive to the Syrian people, just like we saw our wars in Iraq and Libya turned out to be worse off for the people of those countries. And just like in those two countries, we're already seeing this war we've been waging for years has only proven to strengthen these terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and like ISIS, who are trying to overthrow the government so that they can walk in and fill that vacuum and take over all of Syria.
So she's talking about our wreckage in the region.
I mean, she's certainly right that it's been a disaster for the people of Iraq, for the people of Libya. I'm seeing reports of slave markets in Libya now. The International Migration Organization put out a statement saying that they think that there's substantial evidence of that. Everybody's supposed to be cheering that Gaddafi fell, and Libya has become a disaster in many respects.
Can you tell me some more about that?
There was a report in The Guardian earlier this week about allegations from people who apparently witnessed slave markets in Libya. They didn't have a lot of details, but the International Migration Organization seemed to think that it was a credible source, and they seemed to be a credible organization. I dropped them, I can't remember where their offices are. I don't know if they're in London or Geneva. I dropped them a line. They didn't respond. So I don't know if they have any more to say about that, but I think that that's a very interesting story and just an indication of the disasters that these wars that the U.S. Has wrought. But I would somewhat differ with Tulsi Gabbard's framing in that she says, yes, it's a disaster for these people. And I'm saying, yes, but it actually serves a insidious purpose from the point of view of U.S., Israeli, and Saudi strategic right. thinkers. It's not enough to say Trump is an idiot, he doesn't know what he's doing, or for that matter, Obama or Clinton. No. Look at the policy. There is an underlying logic to it that is incredibly insidious. And it has parallels. The U.S. during the Iran-Iraq war, the U.S. backed both sides. Oh, they overtly backed Saddam Hussein, including his use of poison gas, by the way. Rumsfeld helped with the targeting of that when he went over and shook Saddam's hand in the 1980s. Everybody's pretending to be so incensed that allegedly Assad used chemical gas. And we covertly backed the Iranians through the Iran-Contra plan. And let's remember the origins of Al-Qaeda. It's not, breathtaking that we now are on the same side. The U.S. government is basically on the same side in many respects as Al-Qaeda in Syria, because that's the origins of Al-Qaeda was to fight against a pro-Soviet Russian regime Afghanistan, the Mujahideen. So it's in effect come full circle where the U.S. is playing off participants against each other for its own geostrategic goals. It's how the Arab Spring has panned out. There was a quest for democracy among the Arab people, and the U.S. used both a combination of hard power and soft power, media. Al Jazeera, which is out of Qatar, which a lot of progressives, I think, very inappropriately put a lot of hope in, pumped up all of the uprisings in the secular states. Mm-hmm. Right, in Syria and in Libya. So, if you're living under an authoritarian regime, and yes, as I said, government is an authoritarian regime, and you want more freedom, you're willing to go out and risk your life if, somebody's watching. But if you're, somebody who's oppressed in Saudi Arabia, and Al Jazeera doesn't got the cameras rolling, and nobody else does, and you're just going to get your head blown off for no damn good reason, you're going to stay at home. Right. So a lot of mechanisms sort of funneled the Arab uprisings to attack exactly the regimes that weren't complete toadies for the United States, although Syria cooperated with the United States in many respects.
Right. We talked about these precedents, and it seems to me that in all this madness, not enough media have noted that it makes perfect sense that Russia would not want a failed state or a state ruled by Al-Qaeda or ISIS, less than 100 miles from their capital. But how about the Gulf states? Isn't it also a hazard for them to have such a state anywhere near them? I'm wondering, when you talk about goals, they seem to be precarious goals. Like, they don't know what could come after Assad.
That's true, but I think that the instability and the fighting in Syria is useful to them. It keeps these jihadists off of their back because they don't want them, like what they did with bin Laden. Bin Laden was a, jihadi upstart. Let's get him the hell away from Saudi Arabia. Let's send him to Afghanistan. Let's send these young testosterone-driven jihadis want to fight. Let's ship them off to Syria. Mm-hmm. So that they don't spend their time and energies attempting to reformulate the Saudi kingdom, which is, authoritarian, but from, even a strict Islamic perspective, doesn't abide by some things that some jihadis who are, quote-unquote, true believers, rather than the Saudi royals who are just sort of in it for themselves.
So you are immersed in media day to day. And so what is your reaction to the rollout to what appears to be the same playbook used in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq?
Well,
it's been amazing to me that people are just swallowing whole cloth this issue around these weapons of mass destruction, this chemical attack. You know, now you're getting an analyst coming out and debunking the whole thing. But by and large, Congress, the media, they seem to be cheering it on and just serving the same purpose that they did before.
I think that that's totally true, and I think that it points to two things that I think might be challenging to some of our listeners. One is that there is a unique role here played by the so-called liberal media to, in effect, push Trump to polarize with Russia and the Assad regime. They, in effect, militarized Trump. He came in saying, let's intervention. I don't want to, you know, I want to get on with Putin. I want to talk to Assad and so on. And I think that the Trump hatred out of a lot of liberal media has caused, in effect, paved the way for Trump to escalate his militarization. And I think that that was very destructive. And I don't know that there's a way to put that horse back in the barn. So I think that that's a major difference here. I mean, you've had liberal media at times go along with strikes, and there were times when, in the 1990s, in the late 1990s, they were pushing Clinton to bomb Iraq, some listeners might remember, and he didn't do so. His administration said that he would bomb Iraq at a time and place of our choosing, and that ended up coinciding with his impeachment schedule, if people recall. He bombed Sudan the day that Monica Lewinsky was supposed to testify.
What was it called? The Monica bomb or something?
Yeah. And then he bombed Iraq in the Desert Fox strikes the day of his scheduled impeachment, which they delayed 4 days, and then it went ahead and anyway. So my first point being, liberal media helped push this, and that should be held firm in people's minds as to which media did that. Second, yeah, go ahead.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up this segment real soon, but I know you'll stay on for our next segment, and we can pick up some of this then. But I wanted to ask you about the role of Israel outside of this, being the beneficiary of this type of plan, like no regime plan, right, of weakening Syria, outside of them being a beneficiary of that. There are some reports that Israel is actually going into Syria and bombing and taking part in these kind of provocations and attacks on Syria.
Correct.
Have you seen that in any reports?
Yeah, I mean, it's getting very minimal play in the United States. It is happening. They're also, they've been giving medical aid to ISIS at times, allegedly. Either ISIS or al-Nusra. Al-Nusra is the al-Qaeda affiliate. So, I mean,
right.
It's just as bad from a U.S. point of view. I think Israel stands to be a tremendous beneficiary of this. With a weakened Syria, with Hezbollah involved in the Syria war, they can go after Hezbollah more easily now. Mm-hmm. And if they go after Hezbollah, then there's basically no one who's going to speak up with any capacity to do anything. Mm-hmm. When they really go after the Palestinians.
Right.
Okay? I mean, the Russians are preoccupied, the Syrians are decimated, the Iraqis are tied up in knots, Egypt is in total chains under the Assisi government, there's basically no, the Saudis and company are utterly complicit, there's basically nobody on the stage who will do anything when the Israelis decide to further go after the Palestinians. So I think that that is a major part of what's going on.
So a lot of what you lay out sounds very convincing, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners want to know, you know, what we in the resistance can do to counter this type of war policy. You know, when our elected officials are not even doing their job and insisting that they're the ones who can declare war and not declare war.
Well, I mean, people in D.C. have direct access to a lot of these war makers and planners. They come in and out of think tanks, the press club where I work, and they breeze in and out real easy. And there are opportunities if people organize themselves and find out where people are going to be to directly confront them about their war-making, their violence, their horrific policies. In terms of media outlets, I think that there are opportunities to get into news conferences and ask tough questions. I don't know if this was all a scam on Trump's part. I suspect it probably was, that all of his non-intervention and all of his, you know, economic populism was all, you know, sort of a scam. But he was pushed to become more militarized.
Okay.
And nobody is pushing on the other side. Nobody's getting in the news. I mean, this whole Syria thing started with him having a news conference with King Abdullah of Jordan, where the media were pounding him about doing something about Syria, doing something, quote unquote.
Right.
And nobody's pushing on the other side of those news conferences.
Wow. Well, yeah, a lot of us, you're talking about decimation. I mean, the progressive media is decimated.
Correct.
The, you know, RT, which has an opposition view to the war, is vilified. I'm actually very concerned about how they're being considered a propaganda arm when other media aren't considered propaganda arm, and how they actually seem to be targeted by the intelligence community and others to I don't know what's going to happen there, but I see a targeting there. Well, I've been speaking with Sam Husseini, writer and activist who is communications director for the Institute for Public Accuracy and founder of VotePAC.org. His most recent article for Counterpunch is titled, "Is U.S. Policy to Prolong the Syria War?" Now, he's going to stay with me in studio as we discuss the role of media, fake news, and misinformation. Stay with us.
شعب محروم جرب قوم بس لا طريق مسدود بلا ما يكون مفهوم انه محكوم من حكام اللي تدوم عشان اطفالنا تموت واحنا نقول قضاء وقدر بس كنا بزيد الخطر والله سطر في جزء عنده وعي سياسي وناديكم تعالوا معي قبل ما تزيد على عميد ورأي النعي امان والله حماني انساني مش تعباني زي باقي الناس لا بتحكي لا بتسمع بس مهما الزمن دار الوطن رح يرجع
الجيل الثالث يطلع اسرائيل يا اخي الوقت بنسيش بل بالعكس بيزيد تاريخ
سكوت سكون بتناس ام كب بتناس شو حدود بتناس بتناس بتناس
لك الجيل الثالث يطلع اسرائيل يا اخي الوقت بنسيش بل بالعكس بيزيد تاريخ
سكوت سكون بتناس ام كب بتناس شو حدود بتناس بتناس بتناس
تحكي لجواتي لا تراب هو ذاتي ساعدنا واقف على حق وعلى حق اخواتي بهالبلاد شعبي معدوم من الوعي السياسي خذ اثبات.
That was Third Generation by the Palestinian youth duo Damar, which is Arabic, I believe, for destruction. This is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam. And for this segment, writer and activist Sam Husseini is still in the house, and we're joined by journalist and author John Jeter, whose most recent book is Flat Broke in the Free Market. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thank you for having me, Esther.
Well, in the last segment, we were discussing what has happened in the world since Syria's President Bashar al-Assad was accused of directing a chemical attack. The coverage of the flimsy evidence for blaming Assad, combined with the uncritical coverage of the attack, has been, for me, unreadable and unwatchable. Now, you're a former foreign correspondent for the Washington Post. Give me your take on what's happening here.
I think those are the perfect words to describe the coverage, really the coverage in general in the United States of every sort of political and economic issue is unreadable and unwatchable. And I couldn't agree with you more. But it's not really new. It's just sort of a doubling down of the mainstream media's traditional role in the United States. I, as you know, I've been working on a book for a while now on social movements, the history of social movements in the United States, dating back to the end of the Civil War. And the one thing that has become clear is how central to squashing social movements, effective social movements, the press has been traditionally. And just to give you one example, there was an interracial strike, believed to be the first interracial general strike in the United States in 1892 in New Orleans. A lot of European immigrants from Germany, Italy, Ireland, and they joined with blacks to shut down the city for a few days in 1892. I think just months before the Plessy versus Ferguson trial. And the thing that stands out is how the press, the newspapers at the time, bent over backwards to drive a wedge between black and white workers and to portray blacks as menacing. Of course, sexual menaces to white women, but also just violent perpetrators. And because these immigrants, their ideas of whiteness weren't fully formed, it didn't take. They just didn't understand what the press was trying to do. And so you can really draw a straight line from that to what's going on today, where the press is not trying to report what's actually happening on the ground, but it has a very clear political agenda. And I just think, you know, we've seen them double down on that in the years since 9/11. Their ideas, the ideas of the American elite, are so clearly bankrupt, both morally and intellectually. And I think they've just doubled down on the only things they know, which is white supremacy, patriarchy, and folklore.
Well, you know, it's gotten more attention than it should, but I want us to hear on this show Brian Williams on the night of the attack on Syria, and then we'll talk about it.
We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, "I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons." And they are beautiful pictures of fearsome armaments making what is for them a brief flight over to this airfield.
So, John, and then also Sam, I want you to respond to not just the actual broadcast in his words, but a little background on Brian Williams. I mean, a few months ago, it seems like he was like banished from the air, and now he's back and given a pass to spout this type of kind of war criminality on the air. John?
No, I agree. I think it raises and answers the central question. What is the role of the media? Why is Brian? Can you imagine when you or I worked at the Washington Post, being caught in the kind of scandal that he was caught in and then returning to the air? It's unimaginable. And so it really raises the question and answers the question, you know, what is the press, what is the media's intent? And their intent is this kind of jingoism to distract you from the real issues. It's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary moment in history. It underscores the point that there is neither a functioning democracy nor a functioning media in the United States. And also serves to show that we're in very deep trouble, right? They've abandoned all pretense of objectivity, of any serious interrogation of fact, that there is any fealty to intellectual scientific inquiry. So it's extraordinary. It really is.
Sam?
I just highlight that a lot of those same contours which have been there have sort of been aggravated under Trump. That is that Trump, first off, what I said before, you have people like Maddow and others on MSNBC who basically paved the way and helped to try to force the hand of Trump to enter, to further escalate the Syria war.
He's not in Putin's pocket.
Exactly. And that he's going to stand up to Assad and his humanitarian alleged violation of using chemical weapons. And secondly, his sort of braggadocio and crassness and vulgarity and so on sort of helped helps to take the spotlight off of the jingoism and the falsification and the intellectual, I don't know if it's ineptness or I think it's more deceit, frankly, of a large part of the pundit class and the political class. So in that sense, there's sort of a symbiotic weird relationship between Trump. I liken it to, if you've ever seen Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, George and Martha, this demented couple that are arguing constantly, but ultimately collude to destroy other people. And I think that that's a large part of the dynamic that we're seeing between Trump and the establishment media.
So in addition to having this type of content on the air, there's a lot of content omitted. This week, the MIT professor, Theodore Postol, I mentioned, released his analysis that the chemical bomb was not dropped from an aircraft and rather was exploded from the ground. And he's just one person who is kind of joining this chorus to be skeptical, more than skeptical, but actually proving that this supposed attack wasn't done by Assad. So let's just hear what Theodore Postol is saying.
What it indicates is a willingness on the part of high-level people in the White House to distort, to use intelligence claims that are false to make political points and political arguments. And this is a serious, intolerable situation.
So that was Postol, and at that point, I think he was speaking on RT, and I think that it was also covered on Press TV also, but I haven't seen the professor interviewed on any mainstream media. Not that I actually watch a lot of it all the time, but I am forced to watch it. So now, John, you're joining us from Ecuador, and I know that you may have different access to different media there. How is all of this playing out outside of the United States? How do people in Latin America see what's going on?
Unfortunately, I think that the problems with the American media has started to infect all Western media and even, unfortunately, some areas of the Global South, most areas of the Global South, from what I know. And so it is difficult to get news that reflects what's really going on the ground, and that's true here in Ecuador as well, but less true. And also, I think you haven't had this sort of steady drumbeat of trying to gin up all of these fissures, these divisions which separate us and divide us and really ultimately dehumanize us. And so there's less of a chauvinism, of a bigotry, more sort of more serious people, more serious thought. And so you know, you have very clearly, you have, I think you'd see most Ecuadorians are curious, to say the least, about what's going on in the United States with Donald Trump. I think where you might see the real sort of insidiousness, though, of the American press is in that not a lot of Ecuadorians would understand that a lot of these policies that Trump is pursuing were begun or certainly deepened under the Obama administration. And so the Ecuadorians certainly understand that Trump is hostile to Latinos, particularly Mexicans. I would not say that most or even a majority are aware that, you know, Obama had deported more people than any president in history. And so you really see this sort of encroaching mediocrity, this sort of spreading, expanding mediocrity, and it's annexing sort of the press, I think, in other countries. I was watching an interview on the South African Broadcasting Corporation just last night, and you see that they are mimicking the same kind of dumbed down questions and inquiry that you see in the United States. And so it's very tragic. And we really are, I think, at this extraordinary moment in time where we're going to have to sort of rebuild these democratic institutions if we're going to rebuild democracy.
Okay, well, we are actually kind of running out of time. So I wanted to get some final thoughts from both of you. I was going to ask if we had more time to get into kind of like the low points of in media coverage of the last year, because there have been some pretty low points. And I also wanted to get your thoughts about, you know, what media we can support and what media we can that is delivering good information, reliable information, that as Chris Hedges says, what media is living in a fact-based universe at this point. So, your final thoughts, Sam?
Well, to directly answer your last question, I found consortiumnews.com very useful in terms of the Syria crisis especially, but really general foreign policy, and some other stuff too, but primarily foreign policy. I think consortiumnews.com. And you know, that highlights, you know, we're having, you know, John used to work at the Post. Bob Perry, who runs Consortium News, used to work at the AP and Newsweek. So there are good people in establishment media outlets. They sometimes are forced out or made to be uncomfortable and so on. So, but I think that we do need to figure out ways of building up independent media, getting into news conferences, using technology, getting a live stream so we don't have to be disinformed by CNN for 12 hours and then dig ourselves out of the hole through an article. That's counterproductive.
John?
Yeah, I agree. You know, there are some good outlets out there. The problem is that so many of them are thinly resourced. Bob Perry and Consortium News is one that I would mention. Black Agenda Report is, you know, excellent. Mm-hmm. But again, they're thinly resourced. And so the reporting, and that's what's really lacking, is the reporting. You know, I could not get, for instance, very good news, really, for the most part, I couldn't get any news on the elections here in Ecuador. And if you don't live here, you don't understand the issues. You just can't. So it's just not there. It doesn't exist. And I've been seeing this building for a while. I've really sort of abandoned reading the newspapers and have gotten most of my news really from Facebook, my network of friends on Facebook who sort of keep me plugged into, you know, a good story here, a good story there. And so that's how I've really sort of followed the news in the last, I'd say the last 5 years.
Wow.
I found that as well, but it's a very dangerous thing. You know, they can turn on us at any point. Facebook can decide to blackball certain sites or information at any point. So I think that, again, highlights the need for as independent structures as possible.
Well, we're definitely going to continue this conversation. I'll have both of you back to have this continuing conversation about media. And that will do it for today's show. Thanks again to Gerald Horn. And thanks to my guests right now, John Jeter and Sam Husseini. Also, thanks to Chantel James, Michelle Roberts, and Michael Byfield for their reporting for today's show. Thanks to our engineer, Michael Nasella, and thank you for listening. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. You can also hear On the Ground on iTunes under WPFW Radio. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Radio Show. I'm Esther Avam. Keep raising your voice out there. Peace.
Like they say, another theme. I didn't mean to take up all your sweet time. I'll give it right back to you. I wanted to say.